pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And I'd like to thank myself for that introduction. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Trevor's on holidays, and we're joined by the 12th man, Paul. Paul, welcome to the program.
G'day, Scott. How are you?
No, I'm very well, thanks, Paul. Very well indeed.
It's great to be back.
I'm pleased to hear that.
Yes, our mate Trevor has a lot of holidays, doesn't he? I'm always happy to stand in, but gee, how does he find time for all these holidays?
Ah, well, he's off in Tasmania at the moment, and I'm not sure if he's back in time for this weekend's meeting, actually. But
oh, really?
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, good luck to him.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope he's having a great time.
Yeah, precisely.
Hi, Trevor, if you're listening.
Yeah. Yes, Trevor, we've got everything under control, boss. It's not going to fall apart. Yeah. Anyway, because we've got Paul here with us tonight, we'll start off with our disclaimer. And while Paul and myself met through the Secular Party of Australia, that does not mean that this is an official podcast of the Secular Party of Australia. It's a couple of blokes talking about the news.
That's all it is.
Yeah. And, Paul, I think we'll get you to start off with this one.
Really?
We're talking about the sex crimes that have happened in Germany.
It's a bit of a delicate topic, isn't it? Because, you know, as soon as you start talking, you know, criticising the humanitarian action of European countries, in particular Germany, of course. And, you know, I think we in the Secular Party consider ourselves to be humanists, first and foremost.
Absolutely, yes.
People who stand for justice and compassion and helping people in need. And, you know, I'm sure, like me, Scott, you would have felt deep anguish at the sight of refugees, you know, trying to flee Syria or wherever they were fleeing from. For goodness sake, we all know that there are a lot of truly awful places in the world, particularly in the developing world, where people don't have great lives anyway, and then when they're subjected to the brutality of groups like ISIS, Boko Haram in Nigeria, or whatever, or just oppressive governments. You know, our heart goes out to them. But at the same time, I think it's extremely naive. And I think Angela Merkel, I commend her humanitarian spirit, but at the same time, I think she was just plain naive to think that Germany could absorb several million
people
from a culture that is essentially founded on different traditions, different social values, and sometimes very, very different social behaviours, to think that they would just be effortlessly, you know, melted into the German populace without any issues.
It was madness, really.
It was extremely naive. And
yes.
I think, you know, the chickens are going to come home to roost for her in the next few years. And it looks like it's already started, and she's going to get some very, very major problems confronting her.
Yeah, in terms of the popularity question, one of the articles that there's a link to on the website, ladies and gentlemen, there is actually a discussion around the popularity question, and it says, and I can't find it, can't find it. But anyway, it says at the time, it says that she's not suffering any popularity downgrade right now.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. But that said, you know, it's only early days in this.
It is. How long will that last?
I mean, this is the whole point.
I don't know when the next German election is due, but I think they have one every 3 or 4 years, don't they?
I would have thought so, yeah. Yes. I don't know exactly how far apart they are, but I would have thought they'd be every 4 years or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
and it's telling that some of the other members of the European Union have resisted taking so many refugees, because I think perhaps they can see the writing on the wall, you know, that they can't simply absorb all these people without any pain.
Well, that's the whole point that I think you hit the nail right on the head when you first opened it up, saying it was naive of her to believe that you could just effortlessly melt away into into the German population.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think that you could get away with it.
Yeah.
That the, you know, where this all comes from, ladies and gentlemen, is there's a Daily Mail report, and this was from the 7th of January, and they were talking then about the New Year's Eve in Cologne, when there were women there that had been, well, for want of a better term, no, not for want of a better term, it is, they were molested.
They were sexually assaulted.
Yes.
Women were reporting hands and fingers touching every orifice on their body. Women finding hands up their skirts and, you know, being groped and molested in a very, in a violent way, really.
Yeah, it was a violent way, for sure.
Because those women felt extremely threatened, vulnerable, and scared, you know, and if you read the reports, obviously a lot of women were very scared. They were surrounded by hostile-looking men who were groping them, and I believe there were several cases of rape reported.
Yeah, there was definitely digital rape.
Yeah,
and there was also, you know, rape.
Regular rape.
Yeah, whatever the term is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there were. Now this has been thrown into a cover story, is the accusation, is that the police had produced a cover story to try and get people off the scent of the refugees who Germany had taken in.
Yeah.
Now, the the problem with that was that while they did lose their purses, their wallets, their mobile phones, that type of thing, it didn't look like it was a coordinated, you know, assault and grab.
No.
It looked like it was, let's go out.
Spontaneous.
Yeah, it certainly looked that way.
That's the impression I got too. Well, that was just a bunch of men going out, you know, for amusement, as people do, and finding themselves in a situation where they were in sufficient numbers that they could very easily intimidate people, and their targets were mainly local women. And look, I'm not surprised, I have to say, and not because I'm a bigot or, you know, anti-Muslim or any of the labels that some people might try to pin on me, but from what I've read, and I've read somewhat widely about Middle Eastern culture and religion, that it's the headspace that these men are in, where they, you know, they grow up in societies where women are protected and are cosseted and are locked away, largely in many of these societies, and they have a view that women in more liberal societies are basically wanton harlots. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So if they find themselves in a country where all these wanton harlots are walking around on the streets, they, well, some of them at least, see them as fair game.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this is the issue. This is the issue. It's about culture and social values. And if you have a bunch of men, and we all know men, unfortunately, the human male is prone to aggression and violence, in certain circumstances, and I think some of these men, they see these women as fair game, and unfortunately that's the result.
Yeah, agreed. It's bloody awful, really. Mm. Yeah, you know, I mean, you've got you know, there's another article there from the BBC. More than 500 criminal complaints were filed, 40% alleging sexual assault.
Mm.
Apparently retaliatory attacks in Cologne on Sunday were condemned by government as inexcusable. Well, you know, it's inexcusable, but it's understandable.
It is understandable. I don't think the German authorities were quite prepared for that. I don't think they expected it, do you?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think they saw it coming.
No, it certainly looked as though when Angela Merkel opened the floodgates and said, you know, you come to Germany,
yeah,
she was looking at the numbers, you know, Germany is in the heart of Europe is going through exactly what Europe's going through.
Yeah.
What's the word I'm groping for? The fertility rate of women and that sort of stuff
it's
falling.
Yeah.
And suddenly she thought, well, if we then have this injection of young men and women, then we'll be able to overcome our economic problems.
And of course, Germany has had Turkish immigrants for decades.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
And you know, I gather that there has been friction from time to time, but you know, more or less they've integrated. You know, more or less. I don't suppose totally, but you know, I suppose for some people, again, I'm sounding like a bit of a bigot, but you know, I'm not suggesting that these refugees shouldn't be helped. I just wonder how just allowing them to flow into Europe, you know, without any sort of preparation, without any cultural preparation, you know, because these people are carrying their culture and their what they consider to be normal human behaviour with them in their heads.
Yeah, you know? Agreed. And that is the big problem, because when you do take off, you do leave a country because you're under the threat of death or something like that. You do go into a new country, but you carry with you those cultural norms you grew up with.
Absolutely.
And you don't get rid of them overnight.
Yeah. I think Merkel was, like a lot of people, responding to the terrible scenes we saw of people drowning.
Mm.
You know, babies being washed up on beaches, and it was very distressing. And obviously, you know, people want to help. The glaring anomaly here, of course, and we've mentioned this before, is the lack of invitation from wealthy Muslim countries around, you know, the Gulf in particular, where they very plainly and publicly said, no, we don't want refugees.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just madness that you have, you know, a country that could well adopt these people and have them...
And they would have fitted in culturally much more smoothly than they would into a Western liberal culture.
Exactly.
You know, the idea that these people will just melt into the European landscape and adopt European values and European behaviours is just naive.
Yeah, it is naive. Yeah. Mm. But, you know,
what is the solution? I don't know. I'm not saying that I know what it is at all. It's beyond me.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I don't know what the solution is either. But, you know, whatever we've done so far is not working.
No. And again, I suppose, it's an opportunity for me to bash religion again, because I think religion is a big part of it. I don't think it's the total story by any means, but certainly, religion informs social values a lot, and in countries where Islam is such a strong force for shaping social values, I think Islam has a lot to answer for.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's the Islamic values, you know, for want of a better term,
particularly in relation to women.
Yes, exactly. In relation to women, then you take those people that have grown, and these are young men in their early to mid-20s who have made it across multiple countries to then make it into Europe, and suddenly they're presented with a smorgasbord of, what did you call them, wanton hussies or
wanton
something.
Harlots,
you know, it's understandable why they would react the way they have.
It really is.
But it's not acceptable.
It's not acceptable.
Yes.
And what is the solution? I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, I mean, the Pope had said that Europe's humanistic spirit risked being undermined.
Yes, the Pope. The Pope has a bit of a patchy record on.
Yeah, he does. He does.
I mean, for goodness sake, after Charlie Hebdo, he comes out and says, you know, if someone insults you or, you know, offend you, they might get a punch in the nose.
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, he was justifying
these
Islamist outrages.
Yeah.
I mean, I could hardly believe he said that.
Yeah, he's crazy.
But he did.
Yeah.
He said it. So he has a very, very patchy record. He seems to, you know, go one way and then go another, saying, yes, we have to help people and we have to, you know, uphold Western, you know, values. But at the same time, oh, well, you know.
Mm.
Maybe they were justified in murdering, what was it, 12 people at Charlie Hebdo.
Something like that, yeah. It was
and another couple of police and 4 Jewish shoppers in a Jewish supermarket.
Yeah, outrageous.
Absolutely outrageous. Yeah. Now, I'd like to hear the Pope stand up for Western liberal values sometime.
Mm. Rather than just saying that you've got to be able to, that you've got the right to defend religion.
Yeah.
And I think the final word we'll give to the New York Times, okay, where they had, according to Der Spiegel, which is a newspaper in Germany, the report quoted one man in the crowd telling police, "I'm Syrian, you have to treat me kindly, Miss Merkel invited me."
Yeah. Well, you can imagine they would be emboldened by the, you know, open door invitation that the Germans offered them.
Presumably, but you know, to repay Germany in that manner, I think is disgusting.
Yeah.
I would have thought that if you were a genuine refugee, which I'm not doubting that they are,
and many of them are probably very well behaved, obviously.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't want the listeners to think that we're sort of blanketly condemning all these refugees. Obviously we're not.
Mm.
And there's a serious question here, and that is, can a country that, you know, is part of the Western, if you like, the Western liberal camp, just absorb so many people who come with very different social values and social behaviours in their heads, you know?
Mm. It is amazing that that she thought that they could just be absorbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would just effortlessly become German.
Yeah, which is just not the hard case.
No,
yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah. Moving right along.
Yeah.
On to the happier topic of the new Matilda actually brought this up.
Indeed.
No more tax loopholes. It's time for faith groups and religions to render under Caesar.
Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's... Ladies and gentlemen, it's long overdue that faith groups pay their taxes.
Very long overdue.
It really is overdue.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've decided to go with this one because New Matilda is an Australian report. And this is following on from an American... what's the word I'm looking for? Report that we brought up in the week before last,
uh-huh,
where we discussed this from an American point of view.
Yeah.
And if I may say it, the secular party gets a mention here.
Really?
Yes.
Yay, secular party.
Yeah, the secular party got a mention. According to the Secular Party of Australia, tax exemptions could cost taxpayers up to $31 billion per annum.
Wow.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't doubt that it is very expensive, that, you know, the tax-exempt status is costing the budget a fortune. It has to be.
Sure.
It has to be. As to whether or not $31 billion is accurate, well, we don't know.
We don't know. Even if it were $3 billion, still we'd rather have it
spent
on other things.
Exactly.
Surely.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. So even if it was $3 billion, that's still money that could be better spent...
building schools, hiring doctors, teachers, nurses,
that sort of
even thing. Police,
yeah,
for that matter.
Exactly. It's still money that the Commonwealth should be able to put their hands on.
And that they're not getting.
Yeah, and they're missing out on it.
Out. We're all missing out.
Well, we're all missing out on it, exactly. Nominating the purpose, advancing religious, is one of the ways not-for-profits can gain tax-exempt status.
Mm.
Now, advancing religion... Well, what's this? Hugh Harris is the gentleman who's written this article. Mm-hmm. He's probably a little nicer about it than I would have been.
Yeah.
But he actually said that advancing religion at a time in the past had a reasonable claim to be for the public good when religion was something that most people
participated in.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Of course.
You know, if in my parents' day, then you woke up on a Sunday morning and you either went to Mass or you went to church or whatever. You know, unless you were Jewish, in which case you went to the synagogue on Saturday.
Yeah.
But, you know...
or Muslim and you went to the mosque on Friday.
Yeah, you know, that's it, yeah. So,
but you know, when we grew up, there weren't that many Muslims in Australia, of course.
No, there weren't, no. And so, you know, he had a point. It's not a particularly strong point, but it's a point that he raised, that he said that at the time when... religious exemptions, when advancing religion was included in the definition of charity, there was a reasonable argument for it.
Now, what is the percentage of Australians who regularly attend church? I think it's
15%.
I think it's less now, Scott. I saw a figure that was lower than that recently.
Oh, sorry, yeah, fewer than 8% of Australians attend church regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
8%?
8%,
that's
yeah.
down there.
Yeah, it is down there. It's very low indeed.
Very down there.
Yeah, very, 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 very low.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that has... sorry to go off track here a bit, so just to indulge me.
Yeah.
It is one of the things that I've found peculiar in my time watching politics... is why it takes so long for a government to respond to something the community has already accepted. Now, if fewer than 8% actually attend church every Sunday...
The community has moved on.
The community has moved
the
on.
The government hasn't. And
precisely.
For goodness sake, they still have to recite the Lord's Prayer at the beginning of Parliament. And apparently that happens in every Australian parliament, state and federal, except the ACT, I read.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So the ACT doesn't have the...
They don't have it, but all the others do.
Is that right?
They go through the motions, they, you know, stick to convention, the old Christian convention. And look, I'd be willing to bet money there are an awful lot of people in our parliaments who are just mouthing the words and have no real depth of commitment to the content of the
prayer. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And you know, when you get numbers like that, when you actually say that only 8% of Australians attend church regularly, you know, surely it's time for some of the guys and women who are atheists to come out and say, actually, I don't believe.
Yeah.
And then you could actually then start to have an honest conversation about this instead of... pretending and carrying on like you are a rock solid believer and so on and so forth.
Or even not only a believer, but I mean, I think they should be coming out and stating a position, because there are a lot of people in the community who I suspect have sort of lost interest in religion or don't really believe it. But like, even, you know, certain members of my family who've said to me, why do you make such a fuss? It gives people comfort. You know, it doesn't do any harm. Well, I'm sorry. It does a lot of harm.
Yeah, it does a lot of harm.
And I think it's about time politicians should stand up to be counted. If they're not believers, they should stand up to be counted.
Mm.
Can I, while we're on the subject of tax exemption for religions, can I just go off on another tangent and plug a movie? Well, during the Christmas New Year break, I accidentally watched, or you know, came across a screening on TV of Going Clear.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes.
Isn't it interesting?
Very interesting, yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very telling, how the Scientology group were denied tax exemption at first, and they just embarked on a campaign of harassment and bullying, and they did whatever they thought was necessary to cow the what's the American version? Is it the
IRS?
The IRS.
Yeah,
that's right. To cow them into
submission. Yeah.
Into submission.
Yeah,
and gave it to them.
Yeah.
To avoid any further trouble for themselves.
Mm. Well, but isn't this new Matilda? There is Scientology, the world is watching. There is a picture about that, and there is something Scientology in opposing Scientology. Nick Xenophon has proposed a public benefits test to assess the aims and activities of proposed charitable groups.
Yes, it sounds like an eminently sensible suggestion, doesn't it?
Well, I think so. I don't have a problem with that. No, I mean, it's the tax exempt status should come down to what you're actually doing. And I would go even further than that, ladies and gentlemen. This is not secular party policy, so.
No.
But I would go even further than that and say that you should be looking at the profit and loss statement of these organisations, and you should be saying, well, 20% of your expenditure is on administration, therefore you're going to end up spending 20%. You've done away with 20% of your tax exempt status.
Mm.
And then they'll end up paying 20% of their FBT, which they currently don't pay anything, 20% of their CGT, which they currently don't pay anything, and 20% income tax.
What is CGT?
Capital gains tax.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Yeah. So there's fringe benefits tax,
mm-hmm.
capital gains tax, payroll tax, and of course, company tax.
Mm. And we don't necessarily think all those taxes are a good thing anyway.
No.
But if the rest of the community pays it,
exactly.
Why shouldn't they?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, and that is the whole point of this, is that the rest of the community is paying it, therefore these guys should pay it also.
They absolutely should be.
Yeah.
Because they are not necessarily delivering a community benefit. That's
no, they're not. And, you know, even in here, like this line, I think, is telling. The Catholic Church's moral authority has been crippled by the child sexual abuse scandal despite the payouts to victims of sex abuse.
Mm.
The Catholic Church is still the wealthiest private institution in the world.
Yeah.
Now, if something is that wealthy as the Catholic Church is, it really is time for them to pay.
Mm.
Yeah, it's been overdue for them to pay for some time.
Sure.
Yeah. We'll move on from that.
Item next. As they used to say in Hill Street Blues. Did you watch that?
Hill Street Blues?
Yeah, no, it was an old American New York cop drama. I used to watch it many years ago, actually, when I lived in Japan. It was one of the few programs I could watch that was in English, which was a bit of a treat for me in those days.
Yeah, I can understand.
And not a bad show. Item next.
So now we're moving on to Saudi executions, business as usual in the post-Arab Spring world. It's an article from The Conversation, ladies and gentlemen. The Conversations, which I've said before, is tax deductible. So, you know, do make your contributions to it. Saudi Arabia's execution of 47 people on Saturday, January 2nd. Yeah. 47 in one day.
Well, you know, it's economies of scale, isn't it?
I couldn't believe it when I read that. You know, that executed 47 people in one day.
That's phenomenal, isn't it?
It is phenomenal, yeah.
But of course, that's their thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, the death penalty is something they tend to enjoy.
They don't only execute them, Scott. They execute them in public places, for goodness sake. I don't know about these particular guys, whether they are executed publicly. But they do regularly execute people in public places. And they, you know, out in the open, in towns and cities, where the local population get to see what happens to people who don't toe the line.
Is that right? Yeah, that's appalling, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it's certainly not in keeping with our values, our secular liberal values.
Mm.
It's not in keeping, is it?
No, it's not in keeping with them, yeah.
And again, I would argue that their values are very strongly informed by their particular interpretation of Islam.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Which then goes on to talk about this. Al Nimr was a vocal critic of Saudi Arabia's ruling monarchy and had been arrested on charges of instigating unrest in 2012. Now, he was one of those that was beheaded.
Yes, he was a leader of the Shia in eastern Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The Shia community,
yeah.
Which is a minority community in Saudi Arabia, apparently, but they're more numerous in the eastern provinces.
Mm.
And in fact, some of the Gulf states have considerable Shia minorities.
Oh, really?
And I think the Shia are, in fact, a majority in some of the Gulf states.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, interestingly.
Yeah, that is interesting. He was beheaded, and Iran said that Saudi Arabia would pay a high price for al-Namir's execution.
Yeah.
This prompted Saudi Arabia to cut diplomatic ties with Iran.
Yeah.
You could then shelve that and say, okay, that's our little spat, move on.
Mm.
But it gets even worse than that, because the fight in Yemen is basically a Shia versus
Essentially
Sunni.
Essentially it is, a Sunni versus Shia conflict, yes.
Yeah. Now, the Sunnis are backed by the Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
And the Shia are backed by Iran.
Exactly.
Now, once Iraq was denuded, you then had two big kids left. You had Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, the fight in Yemen looks and smells like it's a fight between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
A proxy war between Saudi and
Iran.
Iraq.
Yeah. Now, where that gets interesting then is that once you had the Shia bloke executed, you've then got a government that looks to be behaving like they are anti-Shia.
It certainly looks that way, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does. And that's where it's all come spiralling too now.
Of course, the Iranians look like the height of hypocrisy, criticising the Saudis for executing dissidents. For goodness sake, the Iranians hang homosexuals, hang young women who've been raped for, you know, allegedly having loose morals. I mean, the Iranians are the biggest hypocrites around at the moment.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But it's a very interesting article anyway. The 2000, like, you know, crackdowns during the Arab Spring. The 2000s were a time of hope for many striving for legal and political reforms of the Saudi system. King Abdullah was seen by many as a relatively liberal ruler who would entertain activists and was willing to negotiate on some of the less contentious legal and social issues. But then, you know, now Abdullah died, what, 12 months ago?
Something like that.
Something like that, yeah. And then he had a brother take over? Yeah. He seems to have turned everything on its head and gone and...
I think the Saudis are in a little bit of a tricky situation because they have... I mean, apparently there are people in the population of Saudi Arabia who see the monarchy as not the appropriate or legitimate government of the Muslim world or even of that country. There are certain Al-Qaeda type elements in Saudi Arabia. And so they've sort of got a bit of a balancing act, haven't they? They've got the religious authorities on the one hand wanting them to enforce more and more strict religious observance.
Yeah.
And then they've got the revolutionaries, the underground,
yeah,
who would like to see the whole House of Saud overthrown. So they're, I suppose they're doing their best to manage the situation, to keep everybody either under control or on side.
Yeah, I agree. It's a hell of a mess, really. When you look through this, I mean, like, new counter-terrorism legislation enacted in 2014 effectively labelled political activism as terrorism. I gather it doesn't
they
actually say
has labelled atheism as
terrorism.
Terrorism.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And so you
I've
know,
seen myself as a terrorist before. If I went to that country, I could well be.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, but anyway, that's an interesting one. But we'll have to see. We'll have to watch that with bated breath.
I sometimes wonder how secure the Saudi regime really is. Have you ever wondered that? Whether we might not wake up one morning and turn on the news and find that there's been a major overthrow of the Saudi regime, or a coup of some kind, or you know, a violent uprising.
It's certainly possible.
It wouldn't surprise me too much, I have to say.
Yeah.
I don't know why I think that, but just, you know, I sometimes wonder how strong they really are.
Even, it's certainly possible.
I read something today about Iran, and apparently attendance at mosques, regular attendance at mosques in Iran is, I think the figure I saw was something like 15%.
Is that right?
Yeah. And this is a country that's run by, as we know, a Shia theocracy.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow, you know, they appear to be the minority. The government appears to be representing very much a minority of people in that country.
Yeah.
But of course, they rule by force and intimidation.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's how they took power in the first place, and they're holding on to it with the same means.
Mm. Yeah.
Despite their superficial claims to being an Islamic democracy.
Democracy,
I mean, their democracy is laughable.
Yeah, it really is.
It's a theocratic dictatorship, is what it is.
Agree. Staying with the conversation, with Gonski gone, we can expect more demand for private schools.
Well, that's no secret, is it?
No.
We can see that's happening all around us. People are losing confidence in the public school system and pulling their kids out and sending them to private schools.
Mm. Which is a concern.
It's a concern. Yeah. I mean, at one level, I don't really blame parents. Obviously, parents want the best for their kids, and if they think the public school system isn't serving their interests, then why wouldn't they look elsewhere? But the great tragedy is that Australia has allowed the public school system to deteriorate to this extent, where it's no longer seen as a viable option by so many parents. It's very sad.
Yeah, it really is very sad.
I mean, we look at countries where almost everybody goes to public schooling, like Finland or, you know, probably some of the other northwestern European countries, and they seem to enjoy the greatest levels of social harmony and integration through public schooling.
Yeah, they do, and there's no point sugarcoating it or looking at it any other way, other than to say that Finland, I think it's 80 or 90% of the kids go to government schools,
yes.
And they don't have the problems that we do.
No, and that they seem to have a healthy economy. They seem to have, you know, social harmony and peaceful country.
It seems to work. Yes.
Yes, and surely, I mean, we've probably talked about this before. I think probably many times, but you know, if the government put the resources that are flowing to private schools, if they really put the needed resources into the public schools system, wouldn't we have a terrific education?
We really
system?
Would have.
Surely.
We'd have a much better education.
I can think of no reason why we wouldn't.
It's madness, really. But, you know, if we go through the article, government decision to end Gonski education reforms is a huge blow to the sector. Means funding for Australian schools is not guaranteed beyond 2017.
That's not very far away at all. No.
Between 2009 and 2013, nationwide government funding for private and Catholic schools grew by 23%. 23% in 4 years.
That's a big jump.
It's a very big jump.
Yeah. And of course, it shows the unabashed lying on the part of the coalition prior to the last federal election, where they said Gonski, no problem.
Yeah.
We're with Gonski too. We're all the way with Gonski. You don't need to worry about that.
Mm.
Along with a whole lot of other promises they made that were not honoured after the election. But that's one of the big ones for me.
Yes. Yeah. It is true. Ooh, where do we go from here? Where does this leave Australia's education? key challenge is reducing the achievement gap between rich and poor, along with the consequences that flows from this.
Mm.
And that is a very good point.
Yeah.
It's probably the last point that's made in the article. Yeah, it's the last point I fluoride anyway. Mm. Is that you've got a situation where the children of rich kids, rich parents, they don't go to Mansfield High or the Gap High or any other high.
Yeah.
They go to Brisbane Grammar, to Churchy, to those sorts of schools. Mm. Now, I'm not sure why, but for whatever reason, you seem to have a situation in the schools, in the school that I went to, one of the private schools, mm-hmm. That you seem to have a situation where, because your parents are paid, you tend to work harder.
Mm.
I don't know why that is. But yeah.
So that is true from your experience?
Yeah. Well, from my experience, yes.
Mm.
But, you know, that's not everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's only my experience anyway. Yeah.
And look, you know, I have nothing against kids who go to private schools or their parents, but I sometimes also wonder if it doesn't engender some sort of class division in the minds of the students, Scott. What do you think about that?
It probably does. Certainly when I arrived at uni, I kept my mouth shut a lot.
About your
schooling? Well, about where I went to school and that sort of stuff. And,
yeah.
And, you know, when I was in the classes and that sort of stuff, I did keep quiet about where I went to school and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And I also kept quiet from some of the behaviour I witnessed.
Really?
Yeah.
What sort of behaviour?
It's just rough around the edges sort of stuff. You know, just guys that were just being blokes, that's all.
Mm.
You know, it's just stuff that I hadn't witnessed throughout my school.
I see. So guys perhaps from public school?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's all it was. I mean, it wasn't anything too bad or anything like that, but it was just one of those things that I just noticed, yeah. But, you know, having said all that, you know, I would like to think that we could have government schools that are as well equipped as this school I attended.
Yeah, and they should be.
Yeah, they should be.
They really should.
Yeah, I mean, like, you should get to the point, what we should really have is a situation where private schools don't exist because people just don't bother wasting their money.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's really what we should get to.
Couldn't put it better myself.
Yeah.
If the public school system was so good that people could see no reason to spend all that money sending their kids to private schools, then we would have an equitable and hopefully a terrific system.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say this all the time, but I think it's really true that education is an investment in the future of the country.
Yeah, I agree.
And in the health of society. And why wouldn't we want to put the needed resources into it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, you see things on the internet, people saying, you know, I'm a single bloke, I don't have any children, but I'm happy for my taxes to fund a good education system because I want to live in a good society.
Mm.
And you don't get a good society unless you put the resources into fostering, a well-informed citizenry that is well-educated, well-informed about the world, has a deep level and sophisticated understanding of how the world works and how to create peace, social harmony and prosperity, you know?
Mm, I agree.
You're not going to get that from people who are insufficiently well educated, I don't think. I don't think you could expect that.
Well, you maybe can't expect it, but you can probably expect a lower level, but you've got to be able to have a situation where you ought to be able to insist on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there are a lot of very good, very committed and talented and clever people working in the public school system, but they can only do so much with the resources they have.
Mm. Agreed. Moving right along, Greens leader Richard Di Natale calls for Peter Dutton to be sacked.
Yes.
Do you think he deserved to be sacked?
No, I don't. And look, I'm not Peter Dutton's biggest fan. I think he's rather lackluster as a minister, even bordering on incompetent at times. But I would defend his right to express himself. And for goodness sake, it may have been a joke in very poor taste. I think it was. But it was still, at the end of the day, it was a joke, a misfired joke, but it was still a joke. And surely a government minister doesn't deserve the sack for making a joke in poor taste.
Well, I mean, I don't think he deserved to be sacked either. You know,
I think the issue of free speech comes into it too, Scott.
I really do.
Yeah,
look, just explore that. Let's go through
Well,
that.
For goodness sake, I mean, there's been so much hyperventilating in our community over recent years about people saying things that people think, oh, how could you say that? You know, that's bigoted, that's racist, that's unacceptable to somebody. You know, this idea that we all have to be protected from what other people say, it's just ridiculous. And I think we need free speech and more of it. And so if a government minister wants to say something that's in bad taste, he's, for goodness sake, you know, he's not physically assaulting anyone, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think we need to be protected from bad ideas. I think we need to hear all these bad ideas so that we can analyse them and critique them and put them in their proper place in the scheme of things. I think we need more speech, more open speech. I think people should be unafraid to say whatever it is that they want to say that's in their minds, regardless of its content. And that way the community can decide what they like and what they don't like.
Yeah.
But if they've never heard it, how are they going to decide? How are they going to know? And I don't think we should trust any authorities, whether they be government, academic authorities or whatever, to decide what we should or shouldn't be hearing.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's very troubling. No, it's not troubling. It's kind of par for the course, really, that Di Natale would say this.
Is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I don't know the man too well, I have to say. I haven't followed his career very closely.
Well, I mean, he was he was just on the backbench until Christine Milne left.
Yeah.
And with his departure, we got a different type of person.
Yeah.
And he's done well. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But, he's...
He seems to be doing well for the Greens.
Anyway. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. Precisely.
Christine Milne, for all her faults, I think she was a very sincere person, and I think she suffered from an unfortunate... her facial expression wasn't always endearing, you know? And that sounds very superficial, but I think a lot of people do judge women, especially in the public... in the public forums on their appearance, and she, I don't know, but she came across as a bit harsh sometimes, a bit too sort of doctrinaire, left wing, radical green.
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe Richard Di Natale comes across as a bit more moderate, a bit more open to compromise and negotiation. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. He certainly does come across as more open and more moderate. Yeah. Journalist Samantha Maiden, who's the person that got the mad effing witch comment sent to her by mistake, she hopes Peter Dutton won't be demoted over the mad witch text mishap.
Yeah.
Monday night, Maiden said there was more substantial issues to consider in the aftermath of Mr. Briggs' resignation.
Surely.
Peter Dutton has stuffed up, he's owned up, he's fessed up.
Mm.
I think that's where we can draw a line under this, to be honest.
Yeah, because from the reports, Briggs actually did something physical.
Yes.
He didn't just say something that was unwelcome.
Yeah, he apparently did something to the public servant.
Well, he physically touched her, apparently, in some way.
Is that right?
That was unwelcome.
Yeah.
anyway.
One of our favourites here is Senator Fieravanti Wells.
Yes, that was an interesting story,
wasn't it? She certainly was. She's the Australian Assistant Minister for Multicultural Affairs.
Yeah.
Conchita Fieravanti Wells, deeply misinformed about Islam and other religions.
Mm.
She offered a reality check by injecting what are sort of basic facts into public debate.
Yes. Her idea of facts is quite different
to mine.
To what I, you know, I have to say, one of the great values of my university education was I had a very good history lecturer who started out our course by discussing what is a fact.
Yeah.
You know? And it was something that I'd never been forced to think about prior to that. And, you know, a fact is a very elusive animal.
Mm.
And for her to come out and tell us what the facts of religion are, for goodness sake, that's a very brave move. And she's made herself out to look quite foolish.
Well, she has made herself out to look quite foolish. I mean, like, in this particular line here, Fieravanti Wells astonishingly declares the Quran to be a collection of revelations from God to the Prophet Muhammad.
Wow, that's a big claim.
It's a very big claim, It's, you know, she could have... And it goes on further. It says, you know, she could have, for example, said by saying Muslims believe the Quran to be a collection of revelations from God.
She could have.
She could have, but she didn't. You know, it's a very stupid thing to say.
Very stupid.
Yeah, and then...
wouldn't you wonder that some members of other superstitions wouldn't sort of call her and say... How dare you claim that the Muslims have access to God's truth and, you know, that's in contradiction to what we think is God's truth, you know?
Well, one would have thought so, but, yeah, they haven't, actually, but, you know. Where are we? Then we come down to Fieravanti Wells does not understand that Christians will see her list of basic facts as a crude distortion of what they believe. Does she really mean to imply the Christians of the world have a single overarching authority to establish or forbid religious practices or interpretations of the Bible?
Yeah.
They don't.
No.
We've had this discussion before on the podcast.
If she knows anything about Protestantism, she will know that that was precisely one of the sort of key features of Protestantism was that man can have a direct relationship with God and doesn't need an intermediary.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, and
so I wonder about her background.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming she's Catholic.
Yeah, we do make that assumption from the Mediterranean-sounding name.
Exactly,
And it is an assumption, and we don't really know, but she shows herself to be not at all well-informed about religion.
No, not at all well
And informed. In a position like hers, wouldn't you think she would have been doing some reading?
Well, this is the funny thing about her, was that when the debate was on about same-sex marriage, she stood up and said that you've got to block this because... And she listed off a number of seats that were in danger of falling to the ALP if the Liberal Party then went and backed same-sex marriage. I mean, like, it's...
Because it's offensive to people of some religion.
Yeah, it's offensive to people of some religion, but bloody hell. You know, it's just madness, you know. It's...
Is she representing? The Australian government?
Well,
or certain select minority groups in vulnerable electorates?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, she's probably... representing certain select people in minority electorates. Yeah.
She's playing the political game.
Yes, she is. Precisely. Mm.
Rather than being honest and well informed, which is equally important, I think, in politics.
Yeah, yeah. Too true. And Malcolm Turnbull's first 100 days as PM. Mm. Agile, disruptive, but problems persist.
Yeah.
And...
does he look secure to you?
Yeah, he does. Mm. I think he'll be around at least for this next election, possibly the election afterwards. Yeah.
Wouldn't surprise me either.
And then he'll stand down at that point. I don't think he'll try and better John Howard's time in office.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the big problems with that era, was that Howard didn't know when it was time to go.
He didn't know when to go. No.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was, in a sense, humiliated, wasn't he, at the election? That
well, he lost his seat.
Not many prime ministers lose their seat.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
Yeah. There's an old country and western song about that, isn't it? You've got to know when to keep playing and when to fold your hand.
Yeah.
And walk away from the table.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very true. Turnbull's opening gambit had been a dramatic statement aimed as much as the public as his colleagues. The Abbott government had failed to keep the people on side, failed to inspire business confidence, failed to lead the country at what should have been its most exciting time, and failed to offer the government any chance of survival. He really, in that, I remember the day that he brought it to a head, and you know that when he came down and faced the cameras and said, "This is why we've got to do this." Mm. There was no misconception or anything else. He put it all at Abbott's feet and said, "No, he's got to go."
It was a beautiful ambush.
It really was, yeah.
Because it was just prior to the Canning by-election.
Yeah.
Abbott just didn't see it coming, did he? No. I don't think, anyway.
No, he didn't see
it coming. And even Julie Bishop saw it coming, but apparently Abbott didn't.
Mm.
He was ambushed.
Yeah, absolutely. Sticking with Abbott, Turnbull fatefully predicted that it meant making an unworthy Bill Shorten the next Prime Minister of Australia. Now, the big loser in this change is Bill Shorten.
Absolutely.
You know, he was...
And the whole ALP, actually.
Well, the ALP, yes. You know, the ALP...
Because they're stuck with him.
Well, they are stuck with him, yes, for the time being. Anyway.
Until the next election. He loses the next election, then they'll dump him.
Probably.
Oh, no doubt about it at all. No doubt about it. I think people in the ALP would like to see him gone before the election, but they just apparently have painted themselves into the proverbial corner, haven't they?
Well, I mean, the point is that the leadership changes that Rudd locked in. At the time, I thought to myself, this is great. You know, it's got the backing of the people and that sort of stuff.
It seemed more democratic.
It did, yes. But now they're in a situation that they've got a leader that they really don't want.
And he's locked in.
Well, he is locked in, yes, exactly. So, I mean, they'd be better off... Well, they can't go back on it and change it now. No, they are stuck with it. Yeah.
At least till the next election.
Yeah, exactly.
And he'll lose it. And then he'll be forced to step down and they'll choose somebody else.
Mm.
But, yeah, I think safely we can say Malcolm Turnbull's got another term ahead of him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Mm. At this stage, anyway, you know, it's unlikely that it's unlikely anything that's going to go wrong, really, is it? Yeah.
It would have to be something quite drastic and out of the blue, wouldn't it?
It would be. Yeah.
Can't imagine what it might be, but
yeah.
But usually crises serve the interests of incumbent prime ministers, anyway, don't they?
Tend to, yes.
National security crises especially seem to strengthen their position, if anything.
Yeah. But it's an interesting article anyway. It's from the Brisbane Times, which is from the Fairfax mob.
Yeah.
And then finally, the conversation. We come back to that one. 2015, the year that was, politics and society.
Yes.
So, the opening line, the year started as it finished with terrorist atrocities, intractable conflicts and political upheavals that toppled several leaders.
Mm. Among them, Tony Abbott.
Yes. What do you want to say about it, Paul?
About 2015?
Yeah.
Oh. To be honest, I hadn't thought about it too much.
Really?
No, I'm sorry. I should have given it some thought.
No, you're right.
I think the change in leadership was certainly one of the major events for us in Australia.
Agreed, yeah.
The refugee crisis globally is, I think, the lead story. And it's, you know, far from played out, obviously.
Yes.
Do you know what? I think the issue of China building those fortified islands in the South China Sea is going to turn into a big problem.
Yes, and it was
for Australia
about that.
And for just about every country in the region, I think China is flexing its muscle. It's basically staking claims to the whole South China Sea.
Yeah.
It's a worry. In terms of international law, particularly law of the sea, and everybody is adamant, and I think they're right, that no country has a right to go out into international waters and create a new territory by building artificial islands.
Mm.
And they will arm them. They will fortify them and arm them.
They will be...
In effect, aircraft carriers in the South China Sea.
Yeah. Which is going to be a problem.
It's going to be a problem for everybody.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an interesting article. I won't say too much about it because time's got away from us again. But
does that?
It does do that, yes.
So little time, so much to talk about. An hour just doesn't suffice.
No.
But at least we get to do it again next
week. Exactly. Yes. But, Paul, what's your final observations?
I hope 2016 is a good one for all of us, Scott. And I mean, you know, all of us on this little rock that we inhabit.
Yeah.
What do they call it? Third rock from the sun, is it?
I don't know.
Fourth rock from the sun?
Something like
third,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My feeling is that the liberal centre of politics, which is, I think, the place we inhabit, we want everybody to be happy and healthy and safe, and, of course, our conception of how to achieve that may not be the same as everybody else's, but that's what we want. And to all those who might listen to our broadcast, or to our podcast, I should say, and think, oh, those guys are just anti-immigrant bigots. We're not. We're really not. We're just people who are not afraid to state the bleeding obvious that just because people from a different culture doesn't mean they're right. Mm. You know, I mean, I went to university and did sort of a social science degree, and it was pretty common currency that all cultures are of equal value, all human cultures are of equal value. And it wasn't until years later that I realised, no, I'm sorry, they're not. And you know, we have to be willing to stand up and say, well, you know, our culture is certainly far from perfect, but if we're going to embrace people from other cultures, and I'm all in favour of that, I'm definitely in favour of I work with people of different cultures and enjoy it immensely, but we have to be willing to say what we think is of value and what isn't of value, and what we might gently suggest other people might consider changing in their own cultures.
Yeah, agreed.
And at the same time, what we want to change in our culture. We're always doing that, for goodness sake.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we're open-minded and progressive. That's how I see people like us. And I hope we can really get it together in 2016. It's going to be a significant year, isn't it?
It is going to be a significant year, 2016. We've got a federal election coming up.
We've got a US election coming up.
A US election coming up. Yeah, it's one of those times when you see the US elections playing out, you think to yourself, my God, I wish I was able to vote.
Don't you? Don't you? I mean, I think to be fair, considering the influence the US has on global affairs, they should give at least, even a fraction of a vote to the rest of humanity.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not the undemocratic countries, at least to the other liberal democracies of the world. You know, give us a share of a vote, you know. Maybe we could influence their electoral system for the better.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, you've got that presidential election coming up in November.
That's right.
And, you know, over the next... When do they finalise who their contenders are?
Oh, the primaries?
Yeah.
I think that's like in the first few months of 2016.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So we'll know by March who will be running.
I'm not sure, Scott.
Yeah.
But you may be right.
Yeah.
But in the next few months, I think they'll be having their primaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they give themselves a good 6 months for campaigning, don't they?
I'm not sure. Yeah,
it's a fairly long campaign, much longer than what we have here.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I suspect it's not a good thing. I think, I suspect it's part of the problem in the American system where, you know, they spend so much money on a campaign. You know, they might spend $1 billion. It's a ridiculous amount of money, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that...
The length of time that they... where they have to sustain the campaign...
Yeah.
I think... feeds into this need for these huge, unseemly amounts of money and invites influence from people who have the money to spend and want to influence the government for their own personal gain.
Yeah, agreed. That's one of the good things. Today was Wednesday, the 13th of January, and that was Obama's 7th, it'd be Tuesday the 12th over there, but Obama's 7th State of the Union address.
Yes.
And in that he did say that he wanted to leave behind a system that was not as influenced by money as what he had found.
Yes.
So... you know, let's hope he's successful at that.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah, and of course it won't really be up to him, it'll be up to his successors. Now, the writing is on the wall. If the Republican Party wins the election, it's business as usual.
Well, we'll have to see whether or not the Republicans win the election.
I'm not saying that I think they will. I suspect that they are so crazy, so, you know, right-wing type crazy, that I think they're turning off a hell of a lot of Americans at the moment.
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, like...
let's hope.
You know, one of the podcasts I listen to is Common Sense by mm-hmm. Dan Carlin, and he actually had a recent... on his most recent podcast, he talked about the super PAC votes, the votes that the political parties have got over their... what's the word I'm looking for? The primaries that elect
the candidate.
Yes, if it comes down to it that you still haven't actually chosen your candidate on the day, then you end up with the super PAC votes can go in there, and now they might only be 20% of the votes, but if you've got 50-50 from the elected, and the party wants Jeb Bush to be the presidential candidate, the party can then send their super PAC votes in. And get the outcome they want.
Yeah, Jeb Bush is shaping up as the reasonable candidate.
Exactly.
From the Republican Party.
Yes, he is shaping up as the reasonable candidate, yeah.
Which is scary.
Yeah. But anyway, this is not the last time we'll be talking about the US presidential election, I'm sure.
Oh, you know, Planet America is coming back to the ABC this year, of course.
Is that election. Right?
Yeah. It was one of my favourite programs 4 years ago.
I'll have to watch that. Yeah.
Were you a viewer?
No, I never watched it.
Oh, it's a terrific show and very funny at the same time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll have to watch that. But if there's nothing else, that's it from me, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for tuning in.
Thank you for listening.
No worries at all. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye now.
See ya.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.